Hello and welcome to New Books in Australian and New Zealand Studies. I'm your host today, Dr. Matthew Thompson. I will be talking to Imre Salazinski, author of The Hilton Bombing, Evan Pedrick and the Ananda Marga. Imre was born in Budapest in 1955. He and his family came to Australia as refugees after the 1956 Hungarian uprising. Imre was educated at the University of Melbourne and at Oxford. He returned to Australia and became an academic at the University of Newcastle, which is where I met him some 20 or a bit more years ago when he was my lecturer in Romanticism. He kept his hand in journalism through those years, writing a weekly column, appearing in daily papers across Australia from about 1994 to 2012. He was also serving on the Australia Council from 2006 to 2009. He then left academia, spent 7 years reporting on New South Wales politics, and then in 2013 became senior advisor to former New South Wales Premier Mike Baird through to Baird's retirement in 2017. Imre was also editor of the Oxford Book of Australian Essays. As we'll hear, The Hilton Bombing is the tale of Evan Pedrick, a man who confessed and served time for planting a bomb outside the Hilton Hotel in 1978 that killed three people in an attempt to assassinate the visiting Prime Minister of India. Evan was a member of Ananda Marga, a religious movement at the time based in Bihar, India, but which had adherents in Australia and across the world. And I'll hand it over to Imre. Let's have a chat then. So, hello, Imre.
Hi, Matt. Good to be talking to you.
Likewise. And I should mention, just for disclosure terms, that Imre was my lecturer about 20 years ago in Romanticism and popular essay writing.
Yeah.
So, the Hilton bombing, your biography basically of Evan Pedrick.
Yep.
Could you just tell us how, like, what got you into this?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, Matt. And along with the book, you're one of the productions I'm proudest of as well, I should mention.
Thank you.
Look, your summary biography of me kind of captures the odd way the book has emerged from the different parts of my life that you mentioned, the academia and the journalism. I was a young cadet reporter at the Age newspaper in Melbourne in February of 1978 when a massive bomb exploded outside the Hilton Hotel in Sydney, not in the middle of the night, but in the very, very early hours of the night, between midnight and 1 a.m. And as the duty cadet at the time, I had some very small role in the newspaper's coverage of this, at that time, first and still today, most serious terrorist atrocity that had ever occurred in Australia. As a result of that, I kind of couldn't shake this event out of my mind. It turned out to be the most dramatic news story I had anything to do with, because my first sort of duty in journalism was very brief, and I commenced postgraduate study and an academic career. When I got back to Australia after studying in Britain and eventually commenced an academic career up in Newcastle, where I met and taught you and your friends, the Hilton bombing kind of came back to collect me again, because at that stage, the matter had not been solved. There were people who had been the focus of intense police and media attention in the decade that had then elapsed since the bombing. I'm talking about 1988 now, 88, 89. And some of my students, not you by memory, but other students, some of my brighter students, were very interested in what had happened, what the police had made of it, and indeed the idea that the police and the security forces in Australia were involved in a conspiracy, that they had prosecuted the bombing, and now they were trying to frame an innocent progressive group for the atrocity. And that group was a Indian-based religious cult called Ananda Marga, which was formed in India in the 1960s and grew to some prominence in the 70s under a guru called P.R. Sarkar. Now, let me just stress, Matthew, my students weren't adherents of Ananda Marga. However, Ananda Marga as a cause had been taken up by the campus left since the bombing, and indeed some prominent members of the cult in Australia had moved across to the what I would call radical or far left. So I became interested in the claim that, incredible claim when you think about it, that Australian police and security agencies had placed a bomb outside a hotel in Sydney a decade earlier, where the Australian Prime Minister, the Australian Foreign Minister, various other Australian officials, and a dozen heads of government from the Asia Pacific region were gathered in advance of a regional conference. I became interested in that claim, and then certain dramatic events happened in the second half of 1989, which brought it all back to the front of my consciousness. Now, that's more than 30 years ago, it took a long time for all of this to come together into this book, but that's something I can give you more detail on if you're interested.
Okay, and for a sort of timeline for this then, so the bomb is 78.
Yep.
When did you start to get interested in, is this when you came back through the 80s, is that right?
Yeah, so I got interested again, as I was just saying, in the late 80s when I was teaching at Newcastle. But then, just as I was talking to my students about this theory of a conspiracy, a man came forward in Brisbane and confessed to the Hilton bombing. That confession followed by about a day or less than a day, the arrest in Sydney of a former member of Ananda Marga called Tim Anderson on the Hilton bombing, in which three innocent men had died a decade earlier, to council garbage collectors who were killed when the bin containing the bomb was emptied by them into their truck, and a young policeman who'd been standing on the front steps or near the front escalator of the hotel, among other policemen guarding the foreign heads of government that I just mentioned a moment ago. This man, Tim Anderson, was arrested in the middle part of 1989 on the evidence of a notorious jailbird called Ray Denny. The morning after that arrest, which was heavily publicised, of course, another man named Evan Pedrick came forward in Perth, in Brisbane, I should say. He was originally from Perth, confessed to his part in the bombing and further incriminated Tim Anderson. At a trial the following year in 1990, Pedrick was convicted of murder. In a trial that then concluded in early 1991, Anderson was also convicted of the bombing, largely on Pedrick's evidence. He was then acquitted, that's Anderson, acquitted on appeal the following year. Pedrick went to jail for about a decade, and upon release returned to his native Perth, where he eventually became an Anglican minister. I, in all of this time, had not been able to put this matter out of my mind, and I never got around to writing anything about it. I was busy. I was trying to drum some sense into the heads of you and your young fellow students at Newcastle on the topics you mentioned, including Romanticism. I had young children running around me, but although I couldn't really get to it, I also couldn't get away from it. Now, when Google came along, the internet came along, I discovered this fact of Pedrick's now being a free man and also of his now being a priest. And I thought, my God, there's got to be a story here. And by this time, and I'm talking the first decade of the current century, I'd left academic life and returned to journalism. Now, I got over to Perth in the later part of the noughties on an unrelated project and dropped Pedrick a note saying, could I buy you lunch? He accepted. In 2010, I was over there and met up with him, and we eventually established a relationship of friendship, but also of trust, mutual understanding. And as a result of that, eventually I was able to clear the time in my own life, and it took a number of years for me to properly research and write this authorized biography of the man who bombed the Hilton, confessed to the Hilton, did his time for the Hilton, and now is perfectly prepared to continue to take full responsibility for his role in the Hilton. And this is the first time that his story's been told. And I should just stress, Matt, I use the term authorized biography, and that's there to indicate that he's been involved in every stage of this process. And to my mind, that's a strength of the book, not a weakness of the book, because I believe that he is a honourable and a truthful person who, for a period of 3 years, became a completely brainwashed tool of a religious cult. And during that period, while he had, in effect, outsourced his decision-making, his judgment, and indeed his identity to a cult, as a result of processes that are well understood by those who study these things, as a result of all that, he did an absolutely stupid, terrible, and murderous thing for which, ever since, he's experienced the most deep remorse.
Okay. I remember the heydays of Hare Krishnas in Sydney, but I was more aware of the Ananda Marga as to do with, I guess, Tim Anderson's legal battles and things, rather than seeing them on the streets as a religious group.
Yeah.
So can you just tell us a bit about the Ananda Marga? I mean, it's fascinating what's in your book about, you know, their aim being a world government under people remarkably like them, a benevolent dictatorship, they called it explicitly, yeah, and so on. But when did they start, and how big did they get, and what were their main sort of, you know, lifestyles or activities?
Yeah, so they envisioned a world government under the direction of not just people like them, Matt, but in fact by them. and you're a bit too young to have experienced the presence of Ananda Marga, particularly on Australian campuses. They were never a large group. They were never a particularly prominent group. You would see their posters stuck up around campuses in Melbourne and Sydney. I honestly, Matt, have no memory of them in the 1970s, although I have friends who say, oh, yeah, I can remember Ananda Marga. They were around. So they were never a large group in Australia. They probably at their peak in Australia were under 1,000. Around the world, they were one of the many Hindu-based religious sects that were competing for the custom of Western-based spiritual seekers in the 1960s and 1970s, when, among other things, Eastern spirituality was of enormous interest to young people and those broadly involved in what we would call the counterculture. So Ananda Marga was one of many groups that taught meditation and taught other spiritual disciplines that involved a heightened awareness of the different energy centers in the body, They were also teaching the spiritual work of their guru, a man called P.R. Sarkar. And Sarkar was a rail clerk. Hang on, I'm just going to – sorry about you'll have to edit that out. So Sarkar was a mail clerk who began gathering followers around himself in the late 1950s. And as well as teaching his version of Hinduism, he had, as you've just stressed, an elaborate theory of social revolution, which was called Prout.
Right.
According to Prout, society would go through various cycles. It resembled Marxism to some extent, various cycles in which different classes and groups of people would come into conflict with each other, and then a new group would emerge from that. That would be the powerful group, and the final powerful group would be the Anandamagga, his own followers. And under Anandamagga, and they believed this would happen in their own time, under Anandamagga there would be a new world government, a new world army, a new world governing body. And although to the student left in the 1960s and 70s, elements of this seemed similar enough to a kind of Marxist vision to allow different networks of alliance to emerge. In fact, if you look at Prout with any focus at all, it's quite a scary, sinister, and fundamentally a more of a kind of fascist dictatorship version of human life than a socialist one. None of this, of course, was going anywhere. None of it had any force or likelihood of success. But then something happened in the early 70s, which changed the course of Anandamagga very, very dramatically. Sarkar was arrested for murder in India after a large number of dead bodies were found buried at his compound. The bodies of a number of former Anandamagga monks who had broken with Sarkar. Now, Sarkar spent most of the 70s in jail on those charges. And while he was in jail, something happened to Anandamagga, which has been shown to be not uncommon in the study of new religious movements and cults, which is that a harmless group, a basically marginal and unexceptional kind of group, suddenly turns quite dangerous, suddenly turns quite violent. That's what happened to Anandamagga in the 70s. They began an international campaign of violence directed against official Indian targets that was designed to force the Indian government to release their guru, P.R. Sarkar. Now, in February of 1978, I mentioned that there were a dozen Asia-Pacific leaders billeted at the Hilton Hotel in Sydney. One of them was the Prime Minister of India, Morarji Desai. And as this book shows, Anandamagga found it irresistible to attempt the assassination of Desai while he was in that hotel. And Evan was the member of Anandamagga who undertook this appalling, ill-judged and in the end murderous activity. He built and planted a bomb in two stages in a rubbish bin outside the hotel on the 12th and the 11th, 12th and 13th of February, the second weekend of February 1978. He attempted to detonate the bomb using a remote control device when he thought he saw Desai arriving at the hotel on the afternoon of Sunday, the 12th of February, when it failed to detonate. With an enormous sense of relief, he believed that his guru, P.R. Sarkar, had intervened from his jail cell in India to prevent this horrendous loss of life, and he left Sydney and headed back to Brisbane, where at that time he was a full-time official for Anandamarga. And 7 or 8 hours later, as I was saying before, the bomb exploded as it was emptied into the garbage collection truck.
Okay. And now the Prime Minister, Desai, has it been established if that was him arriving? Would he have assassinated him? Was it?
Yes. So just before I address that, I guess I didn't quite finish filling in quite sufficient detail about Anandamarga in Australia in the 1970s. They were a small group, Matt, but they were an effective and tight group in many ways. They operated by offering meditation lessons to anyone who was interested. But from those meditation lessons, if you wanted to go further, as Evan, who was a young, naive, rather lost spiritual seeker at the time, disaffected with the Protestant religious traditions that his parents brought him up in. If you wanted to go further, then you were initiated, you undertook a series of steps, you basically got sucked deeper and deeper into this thing. And in the case of Evan, who very, very quickly became very, very brainwashed by Anandamarga, in the case of Evan, if you wanted to proceed to a official role with the group, then you went to a 12-week training program. That training program for Evan occurred in the winter of 1977 here in Sydney. In that time, you were completely cut off from the outside world. Every moment of your day was strictly controlled. You were thoroughly inculcated into the worldview of Anandamarga. You were initiated into this picture that they were soon going to be the new, ruling force in the world. And, of course, you were also initiated into a version of Hindu spiritual belief that was quite a sophisticated, valid, and extremely sort of traditional and long-standing way of understanding the relation of the individual to a much larger organism or sublime being. And that touching, coming into contact with that sublime being was the goal, the ultimate goal of all of your meditation and all of your reflection. So that's what Anandamarga was doing in Australia. To answer the question that you've just raised, Evan stood opposite the Hilton Hotel on the afternoon of Sunday, the 12th of February, 1978. He had a remote control device in a bag that he was carrying. He'd put about 30 sticks of gelignite in this bin. Police hadn't even bothered to check the bins. This is 1978. Terrorism had never been experienced in Australia. And as official cars pulled up outside the Hilton, Evan waited to see who would get out and whether it would be Muraji Desai, whom he had learned to recognise by studying newspapers and other sources, and who was a very recognisable figure, a small, compact, dark-skinned man in the traditional sort of Nehru jacket and the kind of white costumes that the Indian leadership of that period wore, and a small, very neatly folded cap on his head, which almost looked like a little tiny upturned boat. Evan thought he saw Desai arriving and tried, as I say, unsuccessfully to detonate his bomb. Now, when all of this got processed through the courts a decade or more later, it emerged that it can't have been Desai that he saw arriving, because Desai, in order avoid a potential demonstration at the front of the hotel by Anandamarga, had in fact been taken up the vehicular entrance at the rear of the hotel. He hadn't arrived at the hotel that afternoon. However, it later emerged that about an hour following his arrival, he had left the hotel by the front entrance to be driven to a reception at the Prime Minister's official residence in Sydney. Now, eventually, the prosecutors, not of Evan, but of the other man that was charged, Tim Anderson, settled on this so-called de se departure theory as the explanation for the impossibility of the original account that was extracted from Evan in the trial and the account that he'd originally given police. It was as the result of that deeply flawed process, largely the result of that, that Anderson's appeal was successful the following year. In terms of what Evan remembered or didn't remember, we have to remember, Matt, that as these events were happening, he was in a state of anxiety, frenzy, and hysteria. And cognitive scientists who look at memory have often pointed out, or have pointed out, that when you're in that kind of a state, often your memories become disturbed, dissociated, dislodged, and in various ways disrupted. That is then, of course, only exacerbated by the effect of time on memory, which is, again, inevitably to dislocate and disrupt. So of that particular, those moments when he tried to, as he thought, kill Meragi Desai, Evan's memories by a decade after these events were something of a mess. However, apart from those moments, his memories were rather detailed, vivid, and as it turns out, reliable, because all kinds of other consolidating details that he was able to give to the police and to the courts, not only about that weekend, but the 2 weeks leading up to it, were, as I say, easily confirmed.
Right. And you mentioned the campaign of violence from Ananda Marga. So there also, attacks in Canberra on the military attaché, is that correct?
There were various attacks around the world, mostly in India, but also in Europe and in New Zealand, where a policeman was briefly kidnapped and held hostage, and here in Australia. In the second half of 1977, there were a number of attacks by Ananda Marga, including an attack on the Sydney offices of Air India, in which animal blood was sprayed over terrified employees, and more seriously, as you say, the Indian military attaché in Canberra, Colonel Iqbal Singh, was assaulted and kidnapped in the second half of 1977, and a member of Ananda Marga was eventually convicted in connection with that and sent to jail.
Okay. And then Evan confesses, goes to jail, and then the stories of the conspiracy or alleged conspiracy seem to keep coming. And yeah. I remember the ABC documentary you write about. So the national broadcaster in Australia, what is it, 1995, plays a documentary, was it called Conspiracy, about it alleging or strongly suggesting that Australia's intelligence or security services planted the bomb so that they could find it and justify more funding and power and things.
Yes, it was in fact unironically called Conspiracy, Matt.
Yeah, and Evan ends up being in jail, having confessed to planting the explosive device that killed three people and injured others, saying, "I did this for these reasons." And he's got the national broadcaster sort of, you know, nudging him aside, out of the way, going, "No, look at all this."
Exactly. And he was the only person in the New South Wales criminal justice system who had to keep insisting he was guilty rather than innocent. So, yes, that ridiculous documentary, and in some ways disgraceful documentary, was broadcast in 1995. And Matt, the conspiracy theories that had been around in the 1980s, they, of course, took a bit of a hit when someone came forward and confessed in the shape of Evan. But the fact that his accused co-conspirator, his alleged co-conspirator, was cleared on appeal, then allowed those conspiracy theories out of the cupboard again. What they relied on after that, however, was the effacement of Evan, or the disappearance of Evan, or the relegation of Evan to somehow an inconvenient footnote in all of this. So in that documentary, which was broadcast on the ABC in 1995, and in which all kinds of conspiracy theories are floated, Evan gets, I think, less than 2 minutes. He gets less than 2 minutes. You're never told that he was a member of an Andamaga, and you're not told that he was convicted and is in jail as this conspiracy documentary is going to air. So they're quite kind of rigorous and pointed effacements of the truth. That they're deceptive, and the conspiracy theories that are now collected into that documentary are various. Well, for example, ASIO, the Australian Security and Intelligence Organisation, planted the bomb intending to discover it at the last moment, create a security panic, and as a result of that, sort of bolster up its own importance and hopefully increase its funding. Or ASIO or other organisations decided to hold a training exercise using live explosives while a dozen foreign dignitaries were were staying in a hotel next to their bomb, and in both cases, idiotically, somehow failed to extract the live bomb with the live detonator next to it from the bin before it was collected by council workers and thrown into a garbage truck. Now,
well, maybe they had to clock off. It was like 5 o'clock, right? We're going, leave the bomb there. We're done for the day.
Exactly. They're a public service unit, and then they presumably have quite strict work practices. I mean, look, the thing to be said about these conspiracy theories is that there hasn't been a single shred of evidence to support any of them. There's been rumour, there's been innuendo, and there's been the kind of, you know, Matt, conspiracy theorising often works like this. Take the example of the Hilton. The bomb was in the bin for 7 hours. The bin was supposed to be emptied during those 7 hours. We don't know why the bin was not emptied earlier because of this ASIO bomb, the Hilton. In other words, you take a small unknown and you build upon that a vast theory or claim that has absolutely no connection to it. The fact that there will always be small unknowns about any event does not mean that there is a conspiracy, or that, in fact, the official story about that event does not happen in this case to be the true story of that event, which is precisely what has been shown eventually to be the case here, because Evan confessed, was convicted, went to jail, and continues, as I say, to take full responsibility for his role in this event.
I'm quite interested in Evan and the emotional state he is and the forces at work on him internally. I read a letter that you have in the book from Evan to his parents after the ABC documentary, and I find it quite moving, really. He says, "At this stage, it seems to have become an accepted fact that I confessed to a crime I didn't commit. This, of course, being in the interests of being able to sustain a sensational conspiracy theory. And not only is it dependent on ignoring the fact that I remain in prison solely on the strength of my confession, but I am forced to the realization that this sort of specious nonsense depends on my acquiescence, my silence. Did you get a strong sense from him of how weird or frustrated or bizarre it would be in his position to be sitting in prison for something you've confessed to and have the national broadcaster playing these nudge, nudge, wink, wink, look, it was everybody else documentaries?
Indeed, I did very strongly get that, Matt. It was a horrendous position to be in because you've done something absolutely terrible. For a decade, you've been unable to live with it. Finally, you've done the only thing that can possibly lead you towards rehabilitation, restitution, and an ability to take your place in the community. And now others are trying to take that away from you. And what are they taking away from you? They're taking your story. They're taking your story away from you. I mean, that's why I'm happy this book is out there, because the last thing that was taken away from Evan was his own story, and now it's been given back. And I mean, one vivid way that he's expressed that to me, Matt, is I became my own jailer. He was now the sole source of his own incarceration because, according to the world, he was some kind of fantasist or maybe a lunatic who, for reasons, again, unknown, had reverse-engineered himself into a massacre in order to emerge as the key protagonist of it. Again, nobody's ever even attempted an explanation of why he would have done that. And can I just, you know, also say in connection to that, Matt, that letter that you quoted, that expresses the unique position he was in, the pain and frustration that he was feeling. And let's state too that his confession and his rehabilitation have a strongly religious element in them too. Part of what this was about for him was making his peace with God or coming again into the presence of the Christian God. And none of that was affected by all of this noise that gathered around him while he was in jail. But it did lead him to what I think was a poor decision. As a result of things like that documentary and all of the other conspiracy theories that were going around, he decided to petition the New South Wales government for an inquiry into his conviction. In order to do that, he had to mount a kind of half pretense that he believed he was innocent. Otherwise, he wasn't going to get the inquiry. He sort of managed that. However, in the end, the government said, no, we won't give you an inquiry, but we'll give you an appeal. Now, that appeal was booted out of court in no time because the court decided that nothing that had happened since Evan's conviction, including the acquittal of his alleged conspirator, cast the slightest doubt on his own guilt. He welcomed the dismissal of his appeal, another kind of bizarre and unusual position to have, and expressed the hope that it would finally put to rest any idea that he was not being truthful in his confession of his role in the Hilton bombing. However, the fact that that appeal had taken place, of course, was also another arrow in the it was another weapon that he was handing to the conspiracy theorists, because they were able to misconstrue that and say, see, Pedrick has now recanted. He never did recant.
Well, if at a meeting at the Hilton Hotel of international leaders in Sydney, a bomb goes off, kills people, we have the the confessed bomber, the attempted assassin, saying, "I did this and I did not act alone. It was in concert with other people. It was a group plan to you know, assassinate the Prime Minister of India." Why wouldn't it be taken more seriously in having, you know, a truth commission style inquiry into just seeing what really went down?
Yeah, absolutely. And Evan has always supported a royal commission into the Hilton bombing. And I think that even now, some sort of inquiry would be highly beneficial, while those some of the victims, the families, but also Evan and others from that period are still alive. There were petitions for inquiries. There were the beginnings of movements towards inquiries, but the governments never were able to bite the bullet. I think there was probably some concern that the such an inquiry would, of course, reveal terrible gaps in the security arrangements for the so-called Commonwealth Heads of Government regional meeting that was taking place at the time. And eventually, the thing acquired so much cultural baggage that I think it was felt that you know, no inquiry could carry all of that through, and it would be better if the whole thing were just put away.
Okay. Looking at Evan as a now he'd be seen as a terrorist. I mean, this event then, I don't think it carried the same terrorism kind of baggage as now. I mean, it is a terrorist act. It kills people and so on. But you know, that label, if that had been applied to him then, he would have got more time, right, than 10 or 11 years.
Indeed.
Does he see himself as a former terrorist? And
I don't think he would disagree that the Hilton bombing was an act of terror. The actions that Ananda Marga was undertaking internationally in the mid-1970s were intended to terrorize the Indian leadership into releasing Sarkar from jail. Indeed, as you say, terrorism was largely unknown in Australia, and Evan may well have received a much more stringent sentence if the events had taken place later. Let me just say on that, though, that another thing that wasn't well understood in Australia at that time was fringe religious movements, brainwashing, and indoctrination of young adult males to terrorist ends. So there was endless skepticism in court, and some of this also fueled the conspiracy theories, endless skepticism that someone like Evan, a highly intelligent young man with no criminal record, a very normal middle-class upbringing in Perth. Evan's father was a Methodist minister who was proceeding in a entirely normal way through his early adulthood, could, within a space of a few months, be turned into a fanatical, brainwashed acolyte of a foreign guru to the extent of being able to be groomed into committing murder. Now, Matt, none of that raises any skepticism today. We've seen it repeatedly, and particularly, including here in Sydney, only 4 years ago, in terms of radical Islamist terror cells being able to spot, recruit, and groom a particular kind of young adult male, and very quickly to be able to reshape their identity to something unrecognizable. So in all of those ways, the trial was sort of very rapidly, or the culture in which the trial took place was rapidly overtaken. And yes, all of that may well have shifted the way that it in fact unfolded.
It's fascinating how it's a sort of precursor to the jihadist movements that we know, but it's a precursor, yeah, on Evan's side, but yeah, not on the court side, not on the media side or anything. It's they don't see what they're looking at, you know, they're not seeing the radicalization process and whatnot taking place. And you know, Al-Qaeda, Islamic State, and other groups have plenty of, you know, tertiary educated members. And
indeed, the November, the 9/11, September 11 hijackers and killers, several of them were, of course, highly educated in European universities. Yes, that's right. And studies of cults, including harmless cults, have meanwhile shown that they too seek their adherents largely among the well-educated European and Anglo-American middle class. And Evan also fit that profile very neatly. A young man, a bit lost, a bit aimless, dropped out of uni, disaffected with his parents' religious tradition, but also a spiritual seeker looking for something else. And, you know, instead of stumbling across something harmless like transcendental meditation or, you know, the student Christian movement or moral rearmament or Judaism or, in fact, mainstream Islam, in fact, wandered into the waiting arms of a cult. That's a phenomenon that's much better understood today. And, of course, we're talking about the great startup era for cults, the 1970s. This is the era of the Moonies and Branch Davidian and the terrible deaths in the jungle with Jones and the Bader Meinhof and all of that.
Yeah, and 1970s, the Manson trial as well.
Yes, the Manson trial as well.
Which... And another group that saw themselves as ruling the world after, you know, a sort of dialectic process, but a race war in that case.
It's interesting, isn't it? There was something in the water in that age. There was something happening. I mean, I try to throw a few suggestions out there on this in the book. I've come to no resolution on it. I'm also not an expert on it. But clearly, as the Vietnam War came to an end, all of the energy that young people around the world had invested into that was looking for other targets. And in a small number of cases, the energy found something like a cult, and in an even smaller number of cases like the one we're talking about, it happened upon a cult that was becoming dangerous and deadly. I say several times in the book, Matt, one of my reflections on all of this is none of it had to happen. None of it was preordained. None of it was necessary, of course. A lot of it is just accident. It's an accident that Evan stumbles into that meditation evening in Hobart, where he was living in the second half of 1977, just at a time when he's looking for something bigger, and that something bigger, Ananda Marga, is looking for someone like him, and Ananda Marga is becoming increasingly kind of crazily dangerous as Sarkar continues to rot in jail. And then guess what? I mean, the most bizarre coincidence of all, the Prime Minister of India comes to Sydney.
Months later, within months, yeah.
Within months. So it's...
And Sarkar got out of jail, right? Did the government give in or something? I read in there it's Bihar State, which seems to be the poor, very poor area, and also the home of a number of like Hindu sects that have adherents in Western countries.
Indeed.
Did the government buckle to the campaign?
Yes, it did, but not openly. Sarkar was conducting a series of appeals through the 1970s, and then within 6 months of the Hilton bombing, an appeal was successful. Now, Desai had hinted repeatedly that if Anandamarga would lay down its campaign of terror, there was the possibility of a political solution to Sarkar's situation. No doubt it's a confluence of legal and political arrangements in India that eventually led to Sarkar being able to be released in the middle of 1978. And he actually died while the Sydney Hilton trials were proceeding in 89 and 90.
Right. So the campaign of violence worked, perhaps?
To some extent. But at the surface level, it was, in fact, a successful appeal.
Right. Okay. And Evan, so he's had his time with the Anandas, which lasted for some years beyond the bombing. He's got his jail time, and then he becomes a priest. His jail time is quite fascinating in your book, where he's in with the most notorious corrupt cop in the country, Roger Rogerson.
Indeed.
And you know, some senior figures in there. Why was he in with that lot? He was, because it's a protective unit, right? But he wasn't. He didn't need protection in jail, did he?
Well, he did to the extent that he had testified originally against someone else. That had earned.
Oh, that's the witness protection part. Okay.
Yeah, but that was in Sydney. When he was with Rogerson and Andrew Kalesic, well-known a man convicted of a notorious murder in Sydney that Evan became friendly with at Bowral, it was no longer in Sydney. It was a medium security jail in Bowral where most of the inmates were under some form of protection. Evan by then was not. Yes, there were a number of corrupt and crooked cops in jail with him who were under special protection and not in the general jail community. We should just patch in there, Matt, that following the Hilton bombing, Evan eventually left Anandamarga, married, became the father of twin sons, and as he increasingly reintegrated into the normal social world, was also increasingly unable to bear the guilt of what he'd done. And as that's
a very painful story there, where he's got his kids, he's growing out of the Anandamarga, and then this urge to confess becomes overwhelming, and he has kids, right, by that stage.
Yes, and it was the inability to be the father he wanted to be, because he never really felt that he was being himself with his sons, just as he never really felt that he was being himself in the quite respectable public service career that he was developing by then. It was the inauthenticity of his position, the inner lie that he was harboring, that eventually ate away at him to such an extent that he had to unburden himself of it. And not just, of course, the inauthenticity with his sons, with his wife, with his colleagues, but with God, because also during those years he'd begun the movement back towards a Christian tradition. While he was in jail, he did, as you say, come across some of the most notorious jailbirds in New South Wales. And I think probably in the course of that was already starting to become the person who would eventually find a religious vocation and eventually find the role that he has today within a community, supporting others and helping them, I would think that he would be a marvelous a priest if you were in jail. To this point, that hasn't been among his duties. He's the parish priest in a community back in Perth. He returned to Perth after his release from jail to be with his family, who'd never deserted him. He's a parish minister.
How old are his kids now? They're twins, aren't they? Twin sons.
He's a grandfather. His sons were born in 1980, so they're now middle-aged men, and he's got a number of grandchildren, and he's a doting grandpa.
Does he have a prisoner vibe? Like, I don't know if you, in your report, you come across prisoners too much, but does he have that kind of contained, quiet, cautious kind of?
To an extent,
someone who's done time. Yeah,
yeah, I think. I of course only have known Evan as a post time in jail. He's a quiet sort of person, reserved and reflective. I think that he's not a fearful person. He's not a scared person. He's not at all a nervous person. I think that his experiences have made him reflective, and I think he's and will always be sad. It's a terrifically sad story. It's sad principally because three men, Bill Favell, Alec Carter, and Paul Burmistrew, were killed in the prime of their lives. Needlessly, senselessly, and stupidly. And it's also a sad story because a good young man called Evan Pedrick had his identity taken away from him, and in that condition did a terrible, terrible thing for which there can never be full reparation. You can't mend the holes in the lives of the families that you've destroyed, but you can do your darned best. To me, the centre of the book is not some sort of forensic study of a terrorist incident. It's not conspiracy theories. It's not cults. It's not an Anna Margo. All those things are there. The centre of the book is a story of guilt, remorse, and the attempt to repair the terrible damage that one has done by taking responsibility for it, of rehabilitation and of rebirth. But having said all of that, Evan fully understands that at the heart of it all is this tremendous sadness on account of what his actions caused. And I just hope that reading this can bring some closure, maybe even some comfort to the survivors and to the families of the dead, because, of course, they're the real victims of the conspiracy theorists. They're the ones whose feelings are most betrayed by all of the nonsense that's gone on around this. They deserve to know what happened to their loved ones. And, I just pray that this book can help that.
Well, they're just being used, aren't they, at the moment? Like the victims are just tools in propaganda and politics. And
I think that when conspiracy theories come in on, whether it's the Kennedy assassination, whether it's 9/11, whether it's this, I mean, they mock the dead.
Yeah, the dead aren't real to them at all. Just lastly on this, from what you're saying there, it makes one ponder capital punishment. If there'd been capital punishment, what was it taken out in the 60s in Australia, right? If Evan had been hanged, or if he'd been in various other countries and states of the US and so on, and had been executed at some stage, it would be quite a different ending to the story, right? Like
absolutely, but especially for him. But you know, it does raise those questions. But in particular, it raises those questions because, you know, Evan was a kind and good person until the second half of 1977. He's been a kind and good person since the end of 1979 and sort of middle of 1980. His identity for three of his 65 years was completely reconfigured, and during that period he was a different person, and as that different person did something that the person before and since can hardly recognize, far less, you know, justify or condone. However, you know, Evan insists that he was not insane and is fully morally culpable for what he did. That is true. And yet it does raise tricky questions for the criminal justice system, not just in terms of capital punishment, but more broadly, if, you know, you can be someone else for a time, who are we punishing? You know, who's in jail? And, you know, disastrously, who have we executed? If it really is possible for your identity to be taken from you and then for you to reclaim it. These are, you know, very broad and very philosophical questions about human nature and criminal justice that I can't claim to resolve.
Well, the military sets out to remake people, right?
Indeed.
You know, put them in a state of mind where they're not hesitant to do what they've ordered to do. And
all kinds of institutions set out to remake people, Matt. The institution where you and I met more than 20 years ago was trying to remake you into a different kind of member of society by providing you with a education into the Western literary tradition. So, you know, it's a kind of, you know, it's a slippery scale, isn't it, between all the different forms of consciousness remake. But a cult, you know, it's different to, for example, a religion, the kind of religion that Evan's involved with now. It's different to a mainstream religion in that it seeks complete control over the initiate's activities 24/7, and it also seeks, to a very large extent, to isolate that initiate with fellow believers rather than the broader society that's around them. So a cult is a very special and specific form of identity, renovation. That's different, you know, to the army on one extreme, or to something like a university at a far different extreme.
And what are you doing next, then, Imre? So are you working on any new writing projects, or?
No, I feel blissfully freed of all of that, Matt. Throughout my adult life, I've always had a writing project of some kind on the go, including all those years as a journalist. Since finishing this book, I've actually felt that I've unburdened myself of something, and there's nothing currently pressing. And I can tell you, you know, I'm 65, exactly the same age as Evan. That, of course, helped us in our getting to know each other as well, and it helped me in understanding his life and his period or periods. But no, I'm open to suggestions, and I'm also open to doing absolutely nothing.
Right. Have you discussed with Evan the current round of terrorists, jihadists, and what is an interesting person to get involved in some sort of?
Yes, I think that. For example, the police who deal with the phenomenon of young adult males being recruited and groomed by jihadists would have a lot to learn by speaking to Evan, because it's very rare not only for someone to come out of the other side of that, but also to have a highly articulated and reflective understanding of what they went through. I would think that the book by itself would have something to say to those who, you know, not just study that kind of thing, you know, as an academic field, but actually have to deal with it in some sort of law enforcement sense. And I would think that Evan would make an interesting subject for those who either study or have a role in, the policing of terrorism. But no, so far he hasn't been. I think occasionally students of that area have reached out to him, and he has had occasional contact and discussion with them. I know that he's perfectly open to it.
One last thought I had on this was last night I was thinking about Northrop Frye that, you know, you had a strong academic scholarly interest in, and where Frye talks about satire taking interest in anything and everything that people do versus the philosopher who teaches a certain way and method of living, stressing some things, despising others and so on, and being very selectful with how people should live, passing moral judgment all the time, and being dogmatic versus the satirist. And I guess the cults kind of start to remind me of that, where there's this rigid, like, lines been put down. I mean, because you're in the book, you talk about the Nundamarga having, like, been very sexually controlling and diet and all kinds of things. And also the lack of humor within cults, whereas, you know, the satire being sort of an exuberant, get dirty, look at everything, try everything, be alive.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, absolutely. A cult like an Andamaga seeks to regulate every last aspect of its members' lives, including very much their sexuality, but also, you know, their eating, their sleeping, their yawning, their going to the toilet. There are rules about all of it. And as you say, that kind of satirical messiness of human life, it's an attempt to not just control that, but really to efface it. Uncertainty, irony, humor, as you say, all of that is attempted to be brought under control. And, you know, you mentioned the sort of ascetic philosophical outlook. It's also, to some extent, the romantic outlook. And something like an Andamago, which promises its initiates a contact with a universal mind, is very, to some extent, reminiscent of the romantic interest in the sublime. Like the Eastern spiritual tradition, the romantic tradition of the sublime does involve some kind of merging of the individual, dissolution of the self into a larger organic body. And that is very risky and very dangerous, because, you know, in undertaking that, you can offload all of the baggage that's ultimately what makes you an individual.
Well, I was reading recently about Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath, how some of their friends say they explicitly modeled themselves for a time on Heathcliff and Kathy from Wuthering Heights, and things went badly off the rails when they just saw themselves, like you're saying, merging into and taking on these archetypes
rather than selves. Yeah,
rather than selves. So it's not satirical, you know. It's utterly serious and determined and dogmatic.
Cults are
and dangerous.
Cults are certainly not the place you want to go for, you know, stand-up humor, for slapstick. But then again, my book, as it traces Evan's career in an Andamaga, does also try to give it a fair shake and to show there were legitimate and sophisticated spiritual understandings here, and there was joy. There was a strong sense of connection with others. There was the strong sense of connection with something larger. There was dancing. There was singing. There was feasting. There were good things here, and at various points, a sect like an Andamaga merges with other wholesome, valid, and nourishing religious traditions. These things all they occur in a continuum. They're not separated off from each other. But you know, at certain under certain strict conditions and at certain times, in certain kinds of new or radical religious movements, things can go very, very badly wrong. We've seen it before, we've seen it since, and we see it in the story of the Hilton bombing.
Well, the Rajneeshis come to mind too, and in Oregon with the mass poisoning.
Absolutely. And when I watched, needless to say, watching that widely discussed Netflix documentary, I was consistently struck by echoes of what I'd been studying myself in terms of the new religious movements of the 70s and Ananda Marga.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, thank you very much, Imre, for your time on the New Books Network. And just to remind everybody, the book's title is The Hilton Bombing, Evan Pedrick and the Ananda Marga, written by Imre Salazinski and published by Melbourne University Press. So do yourself a favour, readers. Anyway, thank you very much, Imre.
Thanks for having me, Matt. I've really enjoyed talking to you.